I'm Stacey Vanek Smith. This year, a lot of scams and scandals came to light. So now the government is keeping a close eye on investment advisors, right?
If I went to work every day in the Department of Corrections and just left the door open and let the inmates out, that's my job, to keep them in line. Did anybody do that at the SEC? Absolutely not.
A look at whether regulators have really toughened up. Plus, losing a job means trimming the budget. But what about financial obligations?
The first thing he said was, I'll try to keep up the child support.
And we offer simple money shape-ups that you can do in a day.
Knowing specifically what your financial goals are really makes concrete what this nebulous savings activity may have been about in the past.
That story and more coming up on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, this is Marketplace Money. I'm Stacey Vanek Smith, in for Tess Vigeland. Here's the understatement of the week. It's been a very volatile summer for the markets. And throw in a dash of securities fraud. Think Bernie Madoff. What will it take for investors to feel safe again? This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider helping its members take charge of their financial strategies and put today's market on their side. More at thrivent.com.
The Securities and Exchange Commission has come under fire in recent months. It's accused of letting corporations run wild in the years leading up to the credit crisis. But the SEC's been very busy of late, filing charges against Bank of America, settling a fraud case with General Electric, and speeding up the pace of investigations. Next week, all eyes will be on the regulator when the SEC's Inspector General releases a report on the Madoff debacle, basically how the agency missed Bernie Madoff's decade-long $50 billion Ponzi scheme. No question, it's been a rough time for investors. And, as Marketplace's Steve Henn reports, it may have been even worse for the agency that's supposed to protect them.
Ronnie Sue Ambrosino never imagined she'd spend August in an RV park outside of Phoenix.
Not in my wildest dreams. You know, I think the hottest it's gotten here is 115.
But she and her husband are stranded in the desert. They were traveling back from Alaska last December when they pulled into the town of Surprise, Arizona, and found out their entire life savings had been wiped out by Bernie Madoff. $1.6 million gone.
I'm fearful that the American investor is unprotected. We're unprotected. What makes you think that some of the other broker-dealers that may also look like Stellars and rock-solid brokers are not doing the same thing?
Despite their big nest egg, Dominique Ambrosino says he was really just a working guy from New York.
Yeah, I was a New York City Department of Correction officer.
A prison guard on Rikers Island. Ronnie Sue was a computer analyst, but they were frugal.
Frugal's putting it mildly. We saved for our future. We banked everything that we could.
For years, they clipped coupons, worked overtime, and then sold their house and invested all of it with Madoff. The plan was an early retirement, traveling across America in their RV. But now that's history. It costs about $1 a mile to keep their rig on the road.
So to get across the United States, go to Florida, a 25 to 2,600-mile trip, would be $25 to $2,600.
So the Ambrosinos are stuck. They blame Madoff, but they also blame the SEC.
How can anybody ever trust the SEC?
You know, we have our money in a viable institution, and nobody was there to check. I mean, if I went to work every day in the Department of Corrections and just left the door open and let the inmates out, that's my job, to keep them in line, keep them, you know, behind the gate. Did anybody do that at the SEC? Absolutely not.
Back in Washington, it's Robert Kuzami's job to close the gate and restore that trust. He's the new head of the SEC's Enforcement Division. When he took the reins 4 months ago, the outlook for the agency was grim.
There had obviously been a great deal of criticism about the Enforcement Division in particular.
It can be hard to remember now, but Jack Coffey, a corporate governance expert at Columbia University, says less than a decade ago, the SEC was an investor watchdog with teeth. The damage to the agency's reputation didn't happen overnight.
Well, I think any governmental agency is going to be influenced by the people at the top. And the people at the top believed in deregulation that did not believe in close governmental supervision.
Under the Bush administration, most political appointees in the agency believed less regulation would create more dynamic markets and spur economic growth. But some investigators at the SEC say they were hamstrung and often had to get the full commission's approval before making relatively minor decisions.
I left disappointed.
James Kaufman was an SEC enforcement attorney for 27 years before he retired 2 years ago.
I was disappointed that the enforcement program was not getting the support from the commission that we had in the past.
During the late 80s, Kaufman investigated the junk bond king, Michael Milken, and helped send him to jail. But in Kaufman's final years at the SEC, he says staff judgments were routinely second-guessed and investigations bogged down.
There was a level of distrust, I think, between the commission and the staff that was unusual in my experience.
It didn't make it any easier to catch crooks or enforce the law. But everyone I talk to now says things inside the SEC are changing. Frontline investigators have more power. They can issue subpoenas and push investigations forward on their own. They're creating new specialized units to police complex markets like credit default swaps. And the pace of investigations and new cases is accelerating. So does this mean the SEC's turned a corner? Jack Coffey at Columbia says maybe.
There has been a change in morale. The SEC is now seeking to be a tougher, stronger enforcement agency and has totally reorganized its enforcement division. But I'm not sure that all is bliss down there yet.
The agency's reputation is still clouded by Madoff, and the entire country may have a tough time moving on. Madoff's victims, like Ronnie Sue and Dominique Ambrosino, can't.
Upset? Of course I'm upset. I should be traveling the country right now, doing what I want to do. What am I doing now? I'm stuck in Arizona.
In the middle of August, with hardly a dime to his name. I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace Money.
This week, President Obama went on conservative talk radio to discuss, what else, health care. Obama guaranteed listeners that he would reform this country's health care system. Of course, how is another issue entirely. The debate moved forward this week, sort of. It can be hard to keep track of it all.
So-called public option.
There's no way I can pass a bill in the House of Representatives without a public option.
You can keep your doctor, you can keep your insurance.
That's a lie.
Choice, competition, reducing costs.
Get a plan that gets people insured without having the government take over insurance.
To help us make sense of this week, we thought we'd turn to our reporter Tamara Keith in Washington. Tamara, where is the consumer left standing at this point in the debate?
I think they're left confused. You know, it's hard enough to figure out what a co-op is or what a public plan is. And then to try to figure out what it would do for you is virtually impossible at this point.
It is very confusing, I have to say.
Yeah.
A lot of it seems so theoretical, but there are, from what I understand, points that everybody can kind of agree on that will affect consumers. What are some of those?
Well, there are several things. One of them would be to require most Americans to have health insurance or they'd have to pay a fine. Also, one provision would prohibit insurers from rejecting customers for pre-existing conditions. We've heard a lot of talk about this.
Right.
But basically, that means that if you lose your job and you're also in remission for breast cancer, you don't have to worry about where you're going to find health insurance because everyone should have to accept you. So there are all of these ideas that even the health insurance companies agree on, Democrats, Republicans, a lot of people think that these are things that can happen, but there are a lot of things they also disagree on.
Well, it's interesting that you say that health insurance would be required, because what happens then if people are required to have it, but they can't afford it? Where does that leave consumers who can't afford health care?
Well, there are several things that could be done that are in the legislation somewhere, and who knows how it'll come out in the wash. But there is discussion of expanding Medicaid. This is the program for low-income and disabled people. And there would also probably have to be some kind of a subsidy for people to help them buy insurance. And that's where this thing gets expensive, and so that's where it gets politically messy.
So, bottom line, it sounds like we don't know much yet, but no matter what happens with the public plan, there will be significant reform of some kind for consumers.
Well, you know, the president has made this a major issue and his party is in control. And so I don't think that he's going to let this year end without some kind of victory that he can hang his hat on.
All right. Well, thank you so much for talking about this with us, Tamara.
Thank you.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrive and Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider, helping its members take charge of their financial strategies and put today's market on their side. More at thrivent.com. And by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. If there's an upside to the last year, credit crisis, a wave of bank failures, a massive recession, it could be that we've seen some positive changes. For now, at least, we're saving more money, and some argue it's the end of our culture of hyperconsumption. So maybe the next time you want to impress someone, instead of showing off your great new phone or great new purse, you can talk about how much money you have in your 401k or how many coupons you've clipped. Okay, so maybe not the world's greatest pickup line, but maybe not the worst. In this week's Straight Story, economics editor Chris Farrell says there are ways to make saving easy and hip.
Americans are saving like there's no tomorrow. 2 years ago, the personal savings rate hovered around 1%. Now it's jumped to more than 4%. It isn't just the numbers that have changed. The way we think and talk about savings is different. We not only praise thrift, we practice it. Of course, the big question is how permanent will it be? Are we really embracing thrift? Or are we simply panic-stricken, fearful of losing our jobs? When the good times roll again, and yes, that day will come, will we abandon our newfound love affair with savings? I say, why not give a creative push to favor the we're becoming more thrifty side of the financial equation? That's what Rory Sutherland, vice chairman at the ad firm Ogilvy, advocates. At a talk last month in Oxford, the ad man pointed out that we've created many opportunities for impulse buying, but we don't make many opportunities for impulse savings. Let's change that. What about mobile text campaigns that remind you to save rather than shop? How about developing a large red button for the home, and whenever you hit it, $50 were dumped into your 401k? Is this crazy? Maybe, but I like it. It isn't all that far-fetched an approach either. Here's a practical example. States promote gambling with their lotteries. I don't like it, but lotteries are popular. So, if you can't beat them, join them. We can make lottery savings funds. You play the lottery with all the excitement of potentially hitting the jackpot, but the state would then put some of the money into a savings account for you, perhaps for retirement. You own the savings account. Alex Roberts, a scholar with the Institute for American Values, notes that about half of the poorest Americans spend some $12 a week on the lottery. If that money were saved and invested, say, at an average annual return of 3%, it could add up to some $30,000 in 30 years. A 6% rate of return, $51,000. It's a win-win situation. Of course, some people object to combining the vice of gambling with the virtue of thrift. It doesn't bother me. Capitalism long ago created the ultimate casino that promotes savings. It's called the stock market. So, here's a call for more innovative ideas that promote impulse savings. In the meantime, what are we waiting for? Let's roll the savings dice.
Chris will be back in a bit to answer your questions in Getting Personal. Many parents save for years to pay those huge college tuition bills. But in the countdown to a new semester, the little things can really start to add up.
Who pays for what? Haircuts, travel home, meals outside of the meal plan.
How to budget for the real cost of college life. It's all coming up on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. It's back to school season. For fledgling college freshmen, that means time to pack up those last few boxes, start picking out classes, and saying goodbye to high school friends. For parents, it's more like financial crunch time. Not only do they have to deal with eye-popping tuition and endless fees, there's also trying to give your kids some basic financial advice, like what it means to take on a student loan, how to budget, and not spending book money on beer. We talked with a few parents and kids about how they're approaching finances for the upcoming year.
My name is Jim Davis. My son's name is John, and he'll be a freshman at Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh, majoring in computer science. He's a very responsible individual. He was a valedictorian, so I don't have any concerns about him going out and blowing money. From a how do we pay for college perspective, that's a little scary. We thought we had a pretty good plan. I mean, we started saving for college back in elementary school. You know, of course, the market crash wiped out most of the profits of the 529 plan. And meanwhile, I was an airline pilot and I lost my job in April. So literally, I've been selling the silverware. I had multiple garage sales in order to just pay the normal bills and also pay what's expected in the tuition bills. Ultimately, the big sacrifice is that we're selling our house and moving to Germany while I go back into the military. We made a commitment that we would pay for his college, and we'll just have to make it happen somehow.
I'm Melissa Yorks from Gaithersburg, Maryland.
I'm Lois Bangiolo, and I'm calling from Gaithersburg, Maryland. I'm going to Smith College. I'm going to be a junior.
Lois is very careful with her money. Not a lot I can tell her budgeting-wise.
I'm not really a big spender, so mainly me and our friends going to get ice cream when we need a break from the cafeteria. I don't have a credit card. I stuck with my debit card, which I feel a lot more secure using because I know I can't go over on that. All online, online banking. It gives me a list of everything I'm spending. Yeah.
It was reminding me when I was in college and there was a skiing class being offered and I had to sign up this is the last day to sign up. So I wrote a check to pay for it, but I didn't have enough in my checking account to cover it. So I called up my parents and they went to the bank and put money in. You know, they were able to just deposit money in the account because the bank people knew them.
That's great. I wish we had the same relationship with the bank now, but also if my parents want to go put money in my bank account, that's great.
Julie Anderson. Daryl is my oldest son. He's 18.
My name is Daryl Anderson, and I'm going to Montana State in Bozeman. Mainly for the scenery, the mountains. I'm a big skier, so I'll be doing a lot of skiing. I've been working for 3 years as a dock boy now. I also got plenty of money from my grad party. I think it should be enough for the year.
Well, I hope it's enough for the year. Who pays for what? Haircuts, travel home, meals outside of the meal plan, lift tickets, assuming we're going to pay for any clothes that he needs, definitely anything school-related we'll take care of. But we're kind of feeling it out this first year. It's really hard to know. Just be aware of what you're spending and keep an eye on it. It can add up faster than you think.
I don't know. Don't worry about it, Ma. I'll be okay in Montana.
I love you, Darrow.
I love you too, Ma.
Am I the only one feeling like there's a toga party in that guy's future? Sending kids off to college is generally the time for several big talks, including the money talk. You don't want your kid coming back a financial disaster. If you haven't quite gotten around to that yet with your freshman, never fear. We've got Janet Bodner here. She's with Kiplinger's Personal Finance magazine and author of Raising Money Smart Kids. So Janet, what's the first thing a parent should consider?
I think the best thing to do is to send your kid off to school with a checking account and a debit card attached to it. It gives them convenience, but at the same time, they're not going to get into the same kind of trouble they might get into if they have a credit card because there's a limit.
Right.
Yes, it is true that they can overdraw the checking account and they can get dinged with a $30 overdraft fee, but even that you can protect against. You can have them set up with overdraft protection so that there's money transferred into the account. If there is some sort of an emergency, you can transfer money into the account. So, you know, they have some protection, but they also have some responsibility for managing their own money. And that's part of the college experience. Any responsibility that you can transfer to them is really well worth doing because they really learn life lessons while they're off there on their own.
Well, speaking of overdrawing accounts, what are some of the pitfalls that kids can fall into that parents should maybe help guard them against?
Well, I think that one thing that happens is kids don't understand how many extra expenses they're going to have. What I hear when I talk to college kids, what they tell me is that the biggest unexpected expense they have is food outside the meal plan. Then there are other unexpected expenses, especially, for example, if a child goes off to school with a car. And boy, I would really recommend against any freshman going off to college with a car because you just don't know what the situation's going to be. But not only are there fees, but then kids say, well, I couldn't find a parking spot, so I parked illegally. So they're running up tickets, you know, and the tickets are going on to the school bill, right? You know, and then the parents are saying, wait a minute, you're running up all these, well, you know, I couldn't find a place to park.
You sound as if you speak from experience.
Yes. Well, you know, you just don't think of these things until your kid does them. And then you think, woohoo. And And there are other unexpected expenses. Fraternity and sorority dues and fees are a biggie because, you know, the kids are freshmen, they get rushed, they pledge a particular fraternity, and then you find out that, gee, not only do you have to pay to live there, but, you know, the fees are $1,000 or more just to join. And who's going to pay that? Again, the parent thought that you were home free when you finished the tuition bills, but now you're getting bills for, you know, $1,000 or more. Do you really want to do this?
So, of course, we cannot talk about kids going off to college and financial independence for the first time without talking about credit cards, because we've had a lot of listeners write in saying that they set their child up with a credit card to go off to college that for emergencies and that they were sort of able to control what the terms of the credit card were, what kind of credit card they got. It sounds like this is not what you would recommend. Why is that?
My personal feelings on this are, first of all, this is another funny thing that parents may not be aware of. You give your kid a credit card and you say this is for emergencies. Well, what qualifies as an emergency for a kid?
running out of pizza.
Exactly. Running out of pizza, new dress for the sorority dance. So I think that the thing is you just need to be aware of that and that this kind of thing is going to happen. If you're okay with that, that's fine. But again, if they're going to be running up bills that someone is going to have to pay later, probably you, then you may not want to go this route. And I still think that the debit card route gives them the protection that you're looking for and allows you to transfer money to them if they need it in an emergency.
Janet Bodner is the editor of Kiplinger's Personal Finance magazine. She's written extensively about kids and money, and she's the author of Raising Money Smart Kids. Janet, thanks so much for coming in.
Oh, it's been my pleasure, Stacey.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider helping its members take charge of their financial strategies and put today's market on their side. More at thrivent.com.
It's time for Getting Personal, the part of the show where we take a few of your financial questions, and Chris Farrell is here as always to help answer them. Hey, Chris.
Hi, Stacey.
First up, we have Caitlin on the phone from Boise, Idaho, which is my hometown. Hey, Caitlin.
Hello.
So you're a student at Boise State University.
Well, I'm trying my hardest to be.
Go Broncos.
Do you want me to step out for a little while? You two can have your Bronco Boise moment.
True blue.
That's right. But Caitlin, on a more serious note, you're facing some issues paying for this coming semester.
Yeah.
What is your question for us?
Well, I'm trying to get out of academic probation. And because I am on academic probation, I'm currently ineligible for financial aid through the government.
Hmm.
Okay.
I'm also in a situation where if I don't take as many classes as I can and complete them, the probation lasts longer and I can't get money for longer. So because of this, I've been looking at getting a private loan, hopefully just about $3,500 and just until spring. In spring, I'll hopefully be able to get the real good loans again.
You know, my general approach toward private student loans is I don't like them.
Uh-huh.
To me, it's much more like a credit card. You know, you got to pay it, and there's not a whole lot of flexibility. They used to be the bridge, and that's why I'm sort of thinking this might be a good move for you. It's a bridge to get yourself out of academic probation quicker. You don't want to be too far in debt. You do want to graduate fairly quickly, and you want to have a plan for repaying it. Because when they hand you that diploma with one hand, they hand you the student loan repayment book with the other.
Don't I know it.
Chris, where should Caitlin go to get her loan? What's the best option when you're looking for private student loans?
You know, there what I do, you go to some of the classics, go to Sallie Mae. If you belong to a credit union, I would check out a credit union. A lot of credit unions will do it. I would also encourage you to go talk to, and I assume you've done this, Caitlin, but, you know, talk to the financial aid people, get some information from them. There's a good resource for a lot of people who are thinking about student loans and the trade-offs and the risks. It's called, I recommend it all the time, finaid.org. I think it's a wonderful resource for people who are borrowing and then thinking about ways to pay it back. But my bottom line message to you is, this is a decent strategy, but I'd really like you to think more about how long this is going to take you to get the degree, and what's your payback strategy, and how much in debt are you going to be?
Well, I'm certainly going to have to think about it a lot more.
Nothing wrong with that.
Well, I hope that helped, Caitlin.
Yeah, very much. Thank you guys so much. Bye-bye.
Bye. And Eric in Grand Island, Nebraska, wrote in with a question about paying for college after the fact. Hi, Eric.
Hello.
What is your question for Chris?
My daughter has a 529 fund, and I chose over the 3 years of her college to take school loans rather than to use the 529 fund.
Right.
And now I have gone back, and I would like to pay off those loans. Now I'm being told that I cannot do that, that that's not an allowable expense.
I don't make these rules, Eric. I really don't. If it were up to me, I would say that is an allowable expense. But no, according to the rules with 529 plans, the way they're written, it doesn't count as a qualified educational expense.
That's what I'm finding out.
You can withdraw the money and you pay income taxes and a 10% penalty, but that is on the earnings. So in many cases with 529 plans, there isn't much earnings there at this point, if any. So the hit may be minimal, but that's one possibility. The other thing is have the beneficiary change. So if there's another family member or there's somebody else within your family that could take advantage of the plan, you could also do something along those lines. Can I throw one other thing in there, Eric?
Go ahead.
Anybody, anyone listening to this, you know, when you want to change the beneficiary to a family member, the IRS has a certain definition of family member. It's fairly comprehensive and is what most of us would consider a family member. But there are some rules and restrictions on what is considered a family member. So before you, you know, you try to change the beneficiary, just go ahead and check the rules to make sure that you're covered.
And my daughter is talking about going to graduate school, and so we may just hang on to this until then and pay for the graduate school and just go through that process.
You know, it sounds to me like this money's going to be used for her education. It's just delayed. That's all.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's still going to work out.
Yeah. I'm not worried about how it's going to get used. I just didn't want to necessarily take on another $16,000 worth of loan payments.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Although what I'm hearing lately is that that's not an unusual amount for student loans these days.
No, unfortunately, no. Eric, thank you so much for calling in.
Thank you. Bye.
And that's all the time we have for Getting Personal at the moment. If you have a question for us, you can give us a call. We're at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY, M-O-N-Y. Or send us an email. You can find the Getting Personal link at marketplace.org. We'll be back with more Getting Personal later in the show. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. It seems like the recession and the unemployment rate are hitting every aspect of life these days, and divorce is no exception. As more parents feel a loss of income, many are asking family courts to adjust child support payments. The bad economy is also pushing some parents into payment delinquency, contributing to the problem of deadbeat dads. From Boston, Monica Brady-Myrov reports.
When someone loses a job, the bills don't stop coming. Mortgage, car payments, health insurance, and for some, child support. But Ned Holstein, president of Fathers and Families, a group that represents dads, says there's a big difference.
Everybody is struggling. But someone who has a child support order is the only person who's going to be put in jail because they can't pay their debts.
That's why more parents who've lost their jobs are asking the courts to lower their child support payments. That's what's happening to Jim Feeney. He's a divorced father of four who lives on Cape Cod. Before he lost his job in January, he made about $85,000 a year. He's required to pay $3,200 a month in child support and alimony. When he was laid off, he immediately asked the court if he could pay less.
First, I filed for unemployment. I filed for welfare, food stamps, because I had no income. I had no savings.
Feeney spoke about his case at a restaurant after his hearing, which he had to wait 2.5 months for. The judge denied his request to lower his payments, and after 6 months of not meeting them, Feeney was put in jail. After 2 days behind bars, he paid a $5,000 fine and was released. But his stint in jail didn't lower his child support obligations and the fines he's racking up because he's not paying.
There's penalties to the state. There's penalties that go to my ex-wife. There's interest to the state. There's interest that goes to my ex-wife.
Feeney's former wife refused to comment for this story, but another ex-wife of another man who just lost his job does have something to say. She's Julie Baker. She's the primary caregiver to two children, ages 5 and 9. Her ex was recently laid off.
The first thing he said was, "I'll try to keep up the child support."
Baker says her former husband has been a supportive dad who's always paid on time. But if the tables were turned...
If I lost my job, I can't say to the kids, "You know what? You can't have lunch today. You know what? You can't. I'm sorry that your shoes are too small."
And more out-of-work parents across the country want to change their child support agreements. But just asking the court to lower your payments because you lost your job isn't always enough. Divorce attorney B.J. Krinsman says the courts are slow-moving.
They're not going to get very far if they go in that week and say, "I lost my job, so I can no longer pay." Usually there has to be some kind of period of time that's gone by. So the obligor has to show attempts to try to get a job.
Some judges are sympathetic and lower payments right away because they know it's unlikely someone will get a new job quickly. But typically it takes 6 months for a judge to make a decision.
And during those couple of months, you can be going broke in a hurry.
Ned Holstein of Fathers and Families.
Then when you get the hearing, typically, the family court judges will not give you relief at the first hearing. They say, "Well, how do we know this is going to be longstanding? You might get a job next week. Also, you've got some assets. You can pay it out of your assets. And so I'll see you again in 3 more months."
But it's putting fathers who mean well and love their kids in jail because they can't pay.
And this is not daddy jail. This is real jail.
But divorce attorney B.J. Krinsman says what ends up happening is that dads borrow money from family and friends.
Usually it is very rare that someone stays in jail for 30 days. So they do find ways to find the money and pay up the back child support and get themselves out of jail.
And when they do get out of jail, they will owe even more because child support obligations don't stop while someone is behind bars. In Boston, I'm Monica Brady-Myrov for Marketplace Money.
Coming up, if your paycheck has taken a hit or your hours have been cut at work, there are a few things you can do right now to put yourself in a better financial position.
One of the best things they can do is finally write down exactly what it is they're saving for.
We offer a few easy financial exercises. And if you want to stay in good financial shape, remember, you can listen to Marketplace Money anytime through our podcast. Subscribe at marketplace.org. You're listening to Marketplace Money from American Public Media. If you have any furlough days in your future, you're not alone. In June, more than 6.5 million U.S. workers said they'd either been furloughed or had their hours reduced. Furlough days mean employers can cut costs without cutting workers. It can be very hard on the finances, but it does also mean more free time. So here at Marketplace Money, we thought, make some lemonade out of those lemons and figure out something you could do with that extra time that would help your money situation. First, I called Jordan Goodman, author of Everyone's Money Book, and asked him if people have one day, what's a project they can do to get their financial house in order?
Well, one project they could do would be to keep track of their debts. A lot of people owe a lot of money and don't really know how much they owe, to whom, what the interest rates are, the payment periods, and so on. So a very simple thing is to set up a spreadsheet where you put how much you owe, how much is paid down, what the interest rate is, so that you can know exactly what's happening with your debts at all time. And then once you've set it up for that one day, then keep it up to date so you really have a good sense of what's happening with your debt.
What are some other things that someone could do in a day?
Another project you could do is to keep track of your insurance coverages. A lot of people are either underinsured or overinsured. Again, write down in a spreadsheet how much you've got, how much you're contributing to it in premiums, what your deductible is. In many cases, if you took one day to evaluate all your insurances, you would find that you could raise your deductibles, lower your premiums dramatically, and make sure you have the right coverage.
All right, so first 24 hours are up, and debts and insurance coverage squared away. Now for the next 24 hours. Let's go longer term, like investments for retirement and sending kids to college. For that, I talked to Stuart Ritter, a financial planner at T. Rowe Price. Hi, Stuart.
Stacey, hi.
Someone has an extra day or two a month. What can they do to help their investments?
One of the best things they can do is finally write down exactly what it is they're saving for. Knowing specifically what your financial goals are, naming them, writing down how much money you need to achieve them, and most importantly, when you want to achieve them, really makes concrete what this nebulous savings activity may have been about in the past.
What are some other investment tips that can be tackled in a day or two?
Start shopping around for some of the other things in your financial life. For example, you can look for a money market that has a higher rate of interest than what you're earning right now, or a bank account that has lower fees or lower ATM charges. These kinds of things can help the expense side of your household balance sheet and start bringing your costs down, and that simultaneously gives you more money available to either spend or save on something else.
A spare day is about what you need to get that resume spruced up. Not a bad idea, given this economy. For this, I called up John Challenger, CEO of outplacement firm Challenger Gray & Christmas. One day, job insecurity, what to do.
Tune up your resume. A lot of times resumes are just filled with kind of the basic information, and yet employers want concrete accomplishments that they could relate into their environment. It might be that you upgraded the payroll system. It might be that you designed an e-brochure for a company.
And once you have your resume finished, you have to get it out there.
Make sure that you put your professional profile, basically your resume, in digital form up there, Facebook, LinkedIn, and others. Today, the social networks provide a great and simple way to tie into your network. So many recruiters and staffing people from companies today look through the social networks for candidates. Just get it done, because some company might find you that way.
For more tips on what to do with your furlough day, visit our website. Chris Farrell weighs in, and we have more tips from our three experts. And we're back with more Getting Personal. Our advice guru, Chris Farrell, is here. So let's get right to the phone, shall we, Chris?
Absolutely. Guru.
You liking
huh?
advice,
okay.
Guru? All right.
I like that.
Well, first we have Suzanne on the phone in Rochester, New York. Hi, Suzanne.
Hi.
What is your question for Chris today?
Well, I understand that some credit using behavior can be a red flag to credit companies, credit card companies, such as purchasing alcohol or using your credit card at the salon. But I wondered about regular monthly bills. Mine are already set up to be paid from my checking account, and because American Express offers double rewards points for paying monthly bills automatically, I wondered if something like that was acceptable.
Yes, and it's very acceptable. I mean, there are a couple of responses to this. One is, it's amazing the amount of detail on our lives the credit card companies have. They're really looking for big changes in behavior. So if all of a sudden you were showing up, you know, you went to the liquor store once every 3 weeks, and then all of a sudden you're going every day. I mean, that might, you know, that might sort of trigger something there, you know.
Right.
So by all means, go ahead and do it. There should be no reason why you should be worried. This is just part of your normal life. They're going to love you because it's the best kind of customer to have.
Great. Thank you.
Does it maybe make the credit card companies think that you're confident enough about your finances that you can pay your bills automatically and things aren't so tight?
That's right. Yeah.
I see.
And it won't have a detrimental effect on my credit score?
No. There's no detriment on there. The things that with automatic bill pay, where you get more of the complaints or people will give you sort of a wary signal, is sometimes it's not as easy to cancel as we'd like it to be, that kind of a thing. But no, I wouldn't worry in terms of your credit score, in terms of revealing things about yourself that the credit card company doesn't already know, or that there's some sort of negative effect here. Remember, they're setting it up for you and rewarding you for setting up this kind of program for you. So I wouldn't be wary of it.
And from what I understand, Chris, 35% of your credit score is accounted for by whether or not you pay your bills on time. So it could actually help your credit score, right?
That's right. And that's a really important point, Stacey. I mean, absolutely. in terms of your credit score, you're showing, boy, you pay it off and it's automatic and it's just going. And so from that point of view, it's also a very good move.
All right. Well, Suzanne, I hope we answered your question.
You did. Thank you very much.
Okay, great. Bye, Suzanne. And Chris, more people are just avoiding credit cards altogether these days. There's Shar in Bainbridge Island, Washington, and she decided about a year ago to use her debit card more and her credit card less. But she knows that there are certain protections that come with credit cards that you don't get with debit cards, like limitation of loss if you report a lost card promptly, or a refund if you purchase tickets for a cruise and the cruise gets canceled.
Right.
Are there important differences between debit and credit cards that people should be aware of, or guidelines for when a credit card might be better?
Yeah, I think there are some guidelines. Now, I don't know about you, Stacey. I would say I probably have shifted 90% using the debit card.
Yeah, me too.
And the credit card I preserve for certain things. You know, if I went and bought a big ticket item like a refrigerator, you know, I'd put that on the credit card just because of the protections that she mentioned in the email. And the same thing with travel. So here's the key. There are a lot of protections in law for credit card users. Your liability is limited up to the first $50, and that's it. And a lot of times you're not even liable for those first $50. So it's really strong with the credit card. Now, with the debit card, there's a different set of rules. If you informed the company within, you know, the first 2 days, your liability is limited to the $50. 2 days to 60 days, your liability is limited up to $500. And then after that, it can continue to go up.
$500 is a lot of money.
It's a lot of money. But here's the reality. MasterCard and Visa have both told their issuing banks, we have a policy of enforcing the same rules as with credit cards. So this is why when you are at the checkout counter and you swipe your debit card and you always go, well, why does it ask for credit? You click on credit and you sign it. And then you are within either the Visa or the MasterCard system and they provide the same level of protection.
Is it only if you push the credit button?
Only if you push the credit button.
Oh.
But, you know, part of it is what risks are you comfortable living with? I'm comfortable living with the policy statement, Visa, MasterCard, most of the time. But if you're really, that's just not enough for you, you can use your credit card. Just don't take on debt.
Okay. And if you want us to take on your financial questions, give us a call. The number is 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY, M-O-N-Y. Or you can write us an email. Just find the Getting Personal link on marketplace.org. You can also look at Chris's blog on our site, where he answers more questions every weekday. Thanks, Chris, for the great advice.
Thanks a lot. It was fun.
This week, you may notice a few changes to how your credit cards are handled. You now have at least 3 weeks to pay your bill. You'll have 45 days warning if the terms change. You'll also have the right to cancel your account. It's all part of the legislation President Obama signed earlier this year. Bigger changes, of course, on the way in 2010. But commentator Jill Schlesinger says we probably shouldn't get too excited just yet because credit card reform is more of a one day at a time kind of thing.
The credit card phenomenon has always felt eerily similar to a drinking problem. In moderation, credit works for most of us. But once there's a habit of overindulgence, things go south quickly. And with credit cards, the drinker doesn't even have to pay up front for his martini. Once hooked, many can't get off the stuff easily. So it's not surprising that the young are targeted. For years, credit card offers have flooded college campuses and lured teenagers with promises of easy credit. Starting in 2010, there'll be far tighter restrictions on how companies can serve these underage debtors. Congress will also require clearer disclosure about the terms of all credit card transactions, so the rules of the game can't change midstream. All well and good, but will the Credit Card Act make a real dent in the scourge of credit card debt? I'm not so sure. Over the past 30 years, too many Americans have formed a dangerous habit. In 1980, U.S. household debt amounted to approximately half of our gross domestic product. Today, debt levels have doubled. That means that household debt is the same size of the U.S. economy. For the 44% of families that carry a balance on their credit cards, paying down that debt will not be an easy task. But questionable credit card company practices didn't cause people to amass staggering sums of debt. That prize belongs to individuals who live beyond their means. And unfortunately, Congress can't legislate financial responsibility. The silver lining today is the deep and painful recession has begun to snap people out of their credit-addicted stupors. While Congress's credit card reform will not do much to reduce consumer debt, that's the job of the borrower, perhaps more disclosure and limits on how credit card terms can change will give debtors a better chance of kicking the habit.
Jill Schlesinger is editor-at-large for CBSMarketWatch.com. Last week, we talked about credit counseling, the pros, the cons, and we asked you to weigh in if you've used a credit counseling service. And we heard from Joy from Rochester, Minnesota.
By the time I was 24 years old, I had 6 credit cards and nearly $30,000 of credit card debt. My initial thought about going to credit counseling was that it was going to be a humbling experience, and laid down all my bills in front of the credit counselor, and she calmly added things up and turned to me and said, "Well, Joy, it's going to take over 4 years, but we can get this all paid off." And I just burst into tears of joy because I had never in my life imagined that I could get out from underneath that debt. Life is definitely better after credit counseling. For me, it was one of the best experiences of my life.
Brett from Santa Monica, California, had a different take.
Basically, I was 32 years old and $25,000 in credit card debt. And my objective was to pay off the debt and to reduce the interest rates. While I was under the program, the credit counseling services sets a monthly payment that you send into them. They negotiate new terms with each of your lenders, but some of the lenders weren't aware of the negotiations. And the interest rates, some went down, but my American Express card interest rates went up 14 times while on the program and reached 30.22%. I would recommend credit counseling if after you've done your homework. When you sign up for the service, you're not just signing up for a payment program. You're actually having something attached to your credit report that's a derogatory bit of information.
We always welcome your thoughts and comments. So if you want to weigh in on this or anything else, go to our website, marketplace.org, and click on Contact. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. Finally, there's something the new credit card regulations won't do: protect you against hackers. Of course, there's now one less to worry about, and he's a big one, Albert Gonzalez. This week, Gonzalez was arrested for hacking into the computers of retail and financial companies and stealing information on 170 million credit and debit cards. Federal agents busted him in Miami Beach. Marketplace's blogger Scott Jagow posted about that story this week and took a brief glimpse into the wild world of hacking.
I found out how Gonzalez and people like him might operate. And it's pretty stunning how complex this crime really is. It's a worldwide market, just like oil, just like corn. And in fact, Gonzalez is known as a harvester. He's very skilled at getting information from company databases, namely, the information that's on the back of your credit card. So the harvester gets the data and then sells it to Eastern Europe, which has become the hub of credit card fraud. From there, your information may wind up on a new card and inserted into an ATM somewhere in the world. I talked to Eleanor Mills of CNET.com about the market for this information. And just like oil or any other commodity, the price actually fluctuates.
The prices have dropped
interestingly, from like what were highs of like between $10 to $16 per record in mid-2007 to less than, you know, $1.50 per record today.
That's because the market's been oversaturated with credit card numbers. So many have been stolen. It's amazingly easy to get this stuff on the internet. I did a simple Google search and found a website where people were listing prices for credit card numbers. And it was pretty much like a menu. You could order a card for $1.50, just the number, or for $3, you could order a card with the security code. And for $15, you could get a card with the Social Security number, date of birth, and PIN. And on this same website, I saw one woman's entire life posted, her account numbers, her password, her address, the answers to those secret questions, her mother's maiden name, everything. It reminded me why I'm so vigilant about checking my balances and checking my credit report. I used to think it wouldn't happen to me, until it did.
That's Marketplace Money for this week. Next time, we'll hear how one compulsive debtor took 12 steps to change her financial habits.
I really was terrified because I was an under-earner, so I supplemented my salary with credit cards. And in my mind, I guess I always thought sometime in the future I'd pay it back, but that didn't happen.
Marketplace Money is produced by Deborah Clark with Stephen Hoffman and Eve Troh. Our technical director this week is Ravi Karman. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yore. Remember, talk to your own expert before you make any big money decisions. I'm Stacey Vanek Smith. Tess Vigeland will be back next week.
There's a lot packed into an hour of Marketplace Money. Check it out again on our website at marketplace.org or take the show with you. Download the show by clicking on the subscribe to podcast link and never miss an episode again. Marketplace Money is supported by Thrive and Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider helping its members take charge of their financial strategies and put today's market on their side. More at thrivent.com.
American Public Media.